and concept director, Terry Wilson. Please keep supporting WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City and the Midnight Ravers. If you'd like to reach us, you can visit us at our website, www.midnightravers.org, MIDNIGHTRAVERS.ORG.
Copyright. The Midnight Ravers.
This is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
You say you care about WBAI, and you want to see WBAI prosper and continue for many years to come. Well, then do everything you can do. Become a WBAI member, or you can become a WBAI buddy. Another great way to offer your support to WBAI is to attend the next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting on Sunday, February 18th at 1 p.m. It is a call-in meeting hosted by Maestro. The call-in number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number is 641-711. All are welcome. We need people to participate in these meetings who are interested in the survival of WBAI and want to share their ideas with WBAI management. Again, the next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be on Sunday, February 18th at 1 p.m. The call-in number is 619-309-1058, and the PIN number is 641-711. I hope you can attend the next meeting.
This is Radio's Uncle Sidney. When I'm out and about, folks comes up to me and says, "You should be ashamed." But when they calms down, they says how much they loves WBAI. That's WBAI New York and WBAI.org. Back in the day, we had commentaries by Malcolm X, Ayn Rand, Abby Hoffman, and William F. Buckley Jr. Imagine them folks in the same room at the same time. Nowadays, we've got Bob Fass, the founder of the feast. Amy Goodman, you know her, we got her. Michio Kaku, the smartest guy in the world. Shows that helps you not to get evicted. Top-of-the-line news and interviews. Insane artists and musicians. All okay, okay. We went nuts for a while back there. But now we're okay. We're like your crackhead cousin that's making good. So we know you're pulling for us. Go, go, run right now to WBAI.org and look around. See where we've gone. You can even subscribe online. Believe me, you'll be glad you did. Stay tuned.
I'm hoping it really is 5 a.m. this time, and you're listening to all. Geez, can black holes really form that way? Radio WBAI New York.
No, I know we're not in Kansas.
Goddamn morning. How the hell are you? This is WBAI New York. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North. Good morning, my dear.
Good morning to you, my dear, and a hearty hello to our dear 19 listeners, wherever they may be.
And this is our 166th pandemic episode of Back of the Book. It's pre-recorded. This program was recorded on Friday for airing on Saturday morning. If things have happened between then and when you're hearing this program, we won't be referencing them on this program. A recorded program is not as up-to-date as a live program, but this is what we have to do in these dangerous times. The top story among all of the galaxy clusters and quasars in the multiverse for this week is we have tumbled down to the still tremendous total of 124 followers on Twitter or X or whatever it's called at this point in time. The next regular WBAI local station board meeting will be held on Wednesday, March 13th, 2024 at 7 p.m. That meeting will be held on Zoom, even though Zoom compromises privacy and security. We had a local station board meeting this past Wednesday. We had to elect people to committees of the Pacifica National Board. See, the Pacifica Foundation owns BAI and four other radio stations, and there is a Pacifica National Board, which is the board of directors of Pacifica. They have committees, and every year we have to elect people from the local station boards to those committees. And so that's what we were supposed to do on this meeting. Well, one of the usual suspects from the so-called Justice and Unity campaign disrupted the meeting. She was alleging that things were being done wrong in a parliamentary sense, and that we'd have to do the start of the meeting differently, even though when that faction had a majority, they did it the way we're doing it now. I mean, on Wednesday, we did it the way we've been doing it for the past 17 years. Doing it differently, of course, would also allow for more disruption. Basically, this person and her faction were trying to impress the newer members of the local station board. And, you know, their tactics were also designed to disparage those of us who are not in their faction. We got most of those committees populated anyway. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has a website, and that CDC website says that as of their last reading, the death toll in America from COVID-19 was 1,178,527, which means that 1,888 people have died from COVID-19 since our last program 1 week ago. So the weekly death rate is lower again. That's good. I'm still wondering if the weather is having an effect on the spread of COVID-19 because it's not the usual winter. We've got a lot of much warmer weather this winter for January and February especially. But that's what's happening there. And that can affect the course of COVID-19, affect the spread of it. Of course, some people are oblivious to COVID-19 because they think that the pandemic is over. That's another factor regarding people catching the disease. The pandemic is clearly not over. Pickles of the North and I are mostly still keeping our masks on. We've gotten our new shots. We don't want to get COVID-19. And a program note. If you tuned in to hear this radio program on the air a week ago, you didn't hear it come on at 5 a.m. It came on about 6.5 minutes after 5 a.m. Wasn't our fault. We, you know, put the program together and we upload it and WBAI downloads it and puts it in the queue to be aired because it's pre-recorded. So we had nothing to do with the timing messing up. But accidents will happen. You know, that's life. The archive was messed up a bit, but I contacted the WBAI webmaster, and he fixed it for us. Thank you, Chris. And we are again recording this program in our bedroom instead of our living room because I still haven't figured out how to fix the HP 2200 printer so that it would grab the paper correctly. I also had to spend an inordinate amount of time that might have been devoted to trying to fix the printer, to trying to upgrade something with some hard drives, and, oh, geez, you know, they don't like the hard drives. Anyway, so I spent hours making tiny little screws hold hard drives into frames and then having to take it all out again and trying to figure out why things are beeping. Yes, with computer stuff, if it starts beeping, you have a problem. And we had a problem. So, oh boy, I'm hoping I can find some way to use those new hard drives I had to buy. You know, sometimes these things just are a real pain in the buttocal appendages. so this past week, we actually had a little bit of snow. Yeah, a little bit. But Pickles of the North noticed some things about the snow. She went out into it. And tell us about your experiences, my dear.
Well, I went out early on Tuesday morning into our storm, or what passes for storms these days. And the snowfall was thick, slippery, heavy, wet snow. And that kind of snow is not easy to walk in because it sort of was melting on the pavement because the pavement was very warm, as were the streets. And at the same time, when you step on it, it ends up refreezing on the bottom of your boot. So even if you were wearing little pikes, I don't know what to call them, you put them on your boots. So if you're walking on ice, those things didn't help because, you know, the snow was slushy and lumpy. And it's not the kind of snow I'm used to walking in February. But I guess I better get used to it because that's the kind of snow we've been getting. And I was talking to my mom later that morning, and she asked me, well, was that sugar snow? That sounds like sugar snow. What is sugar snow, you ask? Well, it's either heavy, wet snow that usually falls in late winter or early spring, and that snow insulates the maple trees. And that's where it gets its name from. And it keeps the trunks of the trees and the roots warm, and it helps the sap to run. And, of course, the sap is gathered by some people to boil into maple syrup. The other definition, I guess you could say, of sugar snow is dry, light snow that looks like grains of sugar. Now, my mom lived on a farm in her very early years, and they had a maple grove there, and that's where they had lots of sugar snow late in the winter or early in the spring. However, I grew up in the city, and my sugar snow was that, oh, it's very tiny, almost needle-like snow. If it hit you in the face, you'd really know it because it stinks. But it looks beautiful, and it looks like sugar, and it glitters like diamonds. I remember one time we were going to midnight mass, midnight mass. The wind was howling. No one else is out. I mean, you know, because, well, I guess some people were going to midnight mass too, but they weren't walking along the street we were walking on. But the snow was gorgeous because it was just glittering the whole way. So it was almost like being in a fairyland when you're a little kid, you know, especially when you know at the end of the mass, which was like at least an hour long, it seemed longer, when you got home, maybe Santa would have come.
Ooh, you know? Santa would have been there. I've seen that kind of snow.
Yes. Oh, it's very lovely snow. And it's usually, and the air has to be really cold and dry.
Yeah.
For that kind of snow. This wasn't, well, this was the other sugar snow. But I did not feel comfortable walking in it, so I actually took a bus to go get the paper, which was why I was out that morning. But and I remember too, my grandma, speaking of snow, my grandmother, who really grew up in the country, I mean her whole life, for generations her family was in the country, up in the Laurentians, or up north, as we used to say, because it's north of Montreal. So she could smell snow. Sometimes she'd stand, you know, she'd go and open the door, and she'd be standing outside on the gallery, and she'd be sniffing and saying, oh, yeah, it's going to snow. You know, there's no clouds in the sky and everything, and she'd be there, and she knew when it was going to snow. And I assume this is because that she grew up, and that's one of the things you develop, I guess, when you're growing up in the country. And this also made me think, too, of, you remember that story by Conrad Aiken's Silent Snow, Secret Snow?
Yeah.
Do you remember that story? Apparently it's from 1932. I've read it. Also, they've made a great version of it. I think it was it Night Gallery? I think they did it. They had Orson Welles doing the narration. Anyway, it's a story about this kid, and he's a little too obsessed with snow, let's just put it that way. But it's got some beautiful descriptions of snow. If you have a chance, you know, read the short story. And one other snowy scene that being outside on Tuesday made me think of was the beginning of the story of Finn Family Moomin Troll. And that is a really great kid's book, and it's written by Tuva Janssen. Yes, and she was a wonderful writer, and she wrote about all these little, they're little trolls. They kind of look like hippopotamuses, but not exactly. And this is just a little bit from Finn Family Moomin Troll that has to do with snow. One gray morning, the first snow began to fall in the Valley of the Moomins. It fell softly and quietly, and in a few hours, everything was white. Moomin Troll stood on his doorstep and watched the valley nestle beneath its winter blanket. Tonight, he thought, we shall settle down for our long winter sleep. All Moomin Trolls go to sleep about November. This is a good idea, too, if you don't like the cold and the long winter darkness. Shutting the door behind him, Moomin Troll stole in to his mother and said, the snow has come. I know, said Moomin Mama. I have already made up all your beds with the warmest blankets. You're to sleep in the little room under the eaves with Sniff. But Sniff snores so horribly, said Moomin Troll. Couldn't I sleep with Snufkin instead? As you like, dear, said Moomin Mama. Sniff can sleep in the room that faces east. So the Moomin family, their friends, and all their acquaintances began solemnly and with great ceremony to prepare for the long winter. Moomin Mama laid the table for them on the veranda, but they only had pine needles for supper. It's important to have your tummy full of pine if you intend to sleep all winter. When the meal was over, and I'm afraid it didn't taste very nice, they all said good night to each other, rather more carefully than usual, and Moomin Mama encouraged them to clean their teeth. Then Moomin Papa went round and shut all the doors and shutters and hung a mosquito net over the chandelier so that it wouldn't get dusty. Then everyone crept into his bed and, making a cozy nest for himself, pulled his blanket over his ears and thought of something nice. But Moomin Troll sighed a little and said, I'm afraid we shall waste an awful lot of time. Don't worry, answered Snufkin. We shall have wonderful dreams, and when we wake up, it'll be spring. Mumbled Moomin Troll sleepily, but he had already drifted away into a hazy dream world. Outside the snow fell, thick and soft. It already covered the steps and hung heavily from the roofs and caves. Soon Moomin House would be nothing but a big, round snowball. The clocks stopped ticking one by one. Winter had come.
That snow we had, it's also known as heart attack snow. For old farts like me, who are dumb enough to decide they're going to go out and shovel the snow, especially when it's still snowing, and you get that snow on the shovel, and it weighs a ton because it's sort of basically all water, which can be quite heavy, and it piles up nicely on the shovel. And you do that for a while, and your heart goes out. I knew a guy who 20 years ago did exactly that, and oh boy, he was a big deal guy in fountain pen circles, since I'm interested in fountain pens, and he had to go out and dig out the place and shovel the snow, and that was the end of him. That was sort of tragic. That was 20 years ago. Ah.
Well, that's very sad, and the important thing is if you're shoveling snow, you push the snow, you don't lift the snow, and that circumvents you having some kind of bad episode with your health.
Well, it makes it less likely. I think if I were to start pushing snow, I'd probably have a heart attack too.
Well, it's a good thing we don't get much of it then.
Well, it's a good thing we don't have to shovel the stuff.
That's true. At this point, I should say that this is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. He is R. Paul Martin, and I am Radio's Pickles of the North.
So we're still in midwinter, but we're headed for spring. It'll get here eventually. Late winter arrives this coming Monday, February 19th, at 2:46 in the morning Eastern Time. And so at that point, we will be in late winter, which is usually better than early and midwinter in terms of how cold it gets. So it should warm up a bit. And, of course, the sun sets after 5:30 in the afternoon now, which is good for people like me who don't like early sunsets. The vernal equinox, when we'll get spring, will be on March 19th at 11:06 p.m. Eastern Time. So that's something to look forward to. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Donnie Bonespur Trump was fined more than $350 million yesterday. Some of his kids have also faced fines, and he's going to be banned from doing business in New York for 3 years. And I'm sure he's going to appeal that. Of course, it's a state thing. He can't just wave his hand and stop it if he even gets elected president, which I truly hope doesn't happen. And I'm sure he's going to appeal it and all of that. But his criminal cases are moving forward. And the judge is not allowing him to say, well, we have to put it off till after I'm done running for president. Judge says, yeah, there's no basis in the law for that. And so he's going to be going to trial on criminal charges. And he's complained about having to show up for these civil cases. Well, he has to show up for a criminal case. As far as I know, if you're charged with a crime, you have to be sitting in that courtroom. I mean, I may be wrong about that. I am not a lawyer, but I think that if you're charged with an actual crime, they require that you show up in court. Whereas with civil cases, you can just never show up at all, and it grinds on without you. You tell lawyers what you want, they go in and they say blah, 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 and wave their law degrees around in the air a little bit, and that's it. This criminal case is really going to have him there. So, oh boy. And he's got a bunch of them. So he's going to have to tiptoe through the tulips to do his campaigning for all the MAGAites. And he's going to have to, you know, fit it in, because I don't think any of the judges are going to say, well, you're running for president, so we'll let you run for office and just ignore the law and all of that stuff. I don't think they're going to give him that. So that'll be interesting. And if he can get convicted before before the election, I don't know how that can affect some things. I don't know. Maybe he can even end up not being allowed to run or something. I don't know. And in some places, they're already doing that, and that's going to the Supreme Court. All this stuff where he put those three people on the Supreme Court, Mitch McConnell, damn you to hell. And he put those three people on the Supreme Court, and I guess the main thing they're doing these days, besides saying, no, we're not going to have abortion in this country, the main thing they're doing these days is watching his stuff and saying, oh, yeah, we got to make sure the guy who put us here doesn't go to prison. Although maybe they won't be that loyal. I suppose there is some hope that they'll say, hey, we got it. We're on the Supreme Court. He can't do anything more for us. Screw him. And they'll just, you know, look at the law maybe and say, oh, yeah, you did all those crimes. You ought to go to jail. That's it. I hope they do that. I want to see him in prison. And right about now, I think it's time for us to do a station break. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, broadcasting from a transmitter and antenna atop 4 Times Square, going through a new studio somewhere in downtown Brooklyn and originating in our living room somewhere else in Brooklyn. The program is back of the book. My name is R. Paul Martin. She is Radio's Pickles of the North, and you can find out more by going up to my website at glib.com, glib.com. You can also go to the official website of this radio station at wbai.org. We've talked on this program before about all sorts of cosmological topics, and we've talked about black holes. We did a whole bunch of stuff on black holes last year, and we're going to talk about black holes a little bit more right now because there's been a new development regarding black holes. And, well, first of all, we should start out, we're going to talk about quasars. Quasar is a made-up word. It's short for quasi-stellar object. So they took quasi and stellar, squeezed them together because people didn't want to say quasi-stellar all the time, so they said quasars. Quasars were discovered in the 1950s when radio astronomy was really taking off. I mean, it had been started by a guy named Carl Jansky in the 30s. And he said, geez, you know, there's all this stuff coming out of the sun, and it must be coming out of other stars. I bet you there are radio waves coming out, too. And he experimented, and he said, yeah, there are. And he found a way whereby he could set up this array of antennas. And it really looks, the original one looks kind of funny. It's just a bunch of antennas, but they are primitive antennas because that's what you need. And it's just a stalk with a horizontal bar on it, and that's the antenna. And he had a whole bunch of these, and he would aim it up at the sky and listen in with a radio receiver. And yeah, he had a struggle to hear various frequencies, but he could do it. And then by the 50s, after World War II was over, there was more technology around that could do this much more efficiently, and he took advantage of that. And other astronomers said, oh, this is interesting. In fact, there is a measurement in radio astronomy named the Jansky. It's named after him. And so anyway, in the 1950s, radio astronomy was booming because it was a new field. And if you got into it, you could discover new things and write new papers. And it was very interesting. So a lot of astronomers, especially younger astronomers, were galloping toward this thing. And astronomers were finding all sorts of new things with radio astronomy in the 50s. And they also found many familiar objects which were also putting out radio waves of various frequencies. For instance, Jupiter is loud in radio waves, and you can listen to other stars, and some stars, you can really focus on them, and they're pretty loud, and they're making some loud radio noise. Others, not so much. You also had what are called radio galaxies, which is galaxies that put out significantly more radio energy than most other galaxies. So you had radio galaxies, and they were doing all of this stuff with radio astronomy. But there were some radio sources that didn't seem to be connected to anything. They were just very bright radio sources. You got a strong signal, you know, like if you're tuning the dial. If anybody has a dial anymore, does anybody use a dial? Don't you just hit a number and it comes up, and or just push a button and it comes up? Well, in the olden days, when people like me started doing things, I still have a dial on the radio. You had a dial, and you turned it, and when you got to a station, you went back and forth a little bit so that you got the strongest reception. You got that when you were basically in the exact frequency where the middle of the signal is, because radio signals kind of spread out a little bit all the time. We're at 99.5 FM. Yeah, this is WBAI New York at 99.5 FM. And we are broadcasting at that frequency, but it isn't like a laser or a maser going out. There's room on either side, 99.5. And in fact, some of that room can be used for another purpose. It's called side bands because they're on the side of the central frequency. And so what can happen is you tune it in and you keep going back and forth. And when it's loudest, that's how you usually do it, when it's loudest to your ear, you say, okay, I got the frequency now. And that's sort of what happened with radio astronomy back in the 50s. And they would look for things and they would get a strong source and they say, there's nothing there. There's nothing at all we can see. I mean, they could see Jupiter if they aimed it. If they aimed it at the sun, of course, they got a ton. If they aimed it at certain stars, they got pretty loud signals. And they could aim it at galaxies and get some signal, and some of them gave a pretty good signal. And then they found they were getting very loud radio sources called bright for astronomers. It's a bright radio source, and there's nothing there. And so they looked and looked. Sometimes when they looked at the spot where they could nail down where the radio signal was coming from, it looked like maybe there was a single star up there far away. And they said, this single star is awfully bright, and it's also obviously far away. What's going on? That's why you got the quasi-stellar sources. So scientists named them quasars for quasi-stellar objects because they were very bright in the radio spectrum, but obviously very small like a star. Spectroscopic analysis showed that quasars had weird spectrums. And spectroscopy is something that was discovered in I believe it was the 19th century. And what happened was astronomers found they could use something that had been used in the laboratory by physicists and chemists. What happens is if you heat something up to a high heat and it glows, it only generally glows in certain wavelengths of light. And if you get an element, like if you have like iron, and you get that really, really hot, and you get it like just about white hot, it gives off various frequencies of light. And you can use get the spectrum of it. You're like you take a glass prism and you put it in front of a ray of light, and it splits the light up. You know, Newton did this and explained it. And it splits the light up into the various frequencies, and you start going from, you know, deep purple to deep red and everything in between. And so you have a spectrum there, and scientists discovered that every element produces a spectrum, a specific spectrum when it's heated up a lot. They didn't know in the 19th century exactly why this was happening, but it was obvious it was happening. What happens, of course, is on the elements that are getting heated up, the electrons are getting heated and they're getting more energy and going into a higher level, a higher electron shell, and then they give up the energy and they fall back down to the lower electron shell. When they drop from the higher to the lower electron shells, they give off more energy, but it's a very specific frequency of energy. And that is, of course, why we have color at all. And so they did that in the 19th century, and they started taking spectroscopic readings of things. That was another big deal, you know, before radio astronomy. And so they did this, and they found that in radio astronomy, they could also do it. They could also get a spectrum of what was coming out of a source. And they did this with the quasars. And so they looked at them, and they were odd. And the couple of them that they could actually see in light, in real light, they had weird spectrums. It was like nothing anybody had ever seen. They matched no known elements or combinations of elements. So this was a huge mystery. What the hell is a quasar? I remember this being a big quandary in the 60s. And the quasars that they could see were so small that changes in their radio and light output showed that they were physically small, no matter how far away they might be. I mean, even if they were sort of close, they would be small. The changes in their light or radio strength, because there are changes that happen, they showed that the source of these radio emissions from quasars had to be maybe one light month wide. Now, a light month is the distance light will travel in 1 month. And if you go from the sun to one light month out, it isn't all that far. You're going to get out past the solar system, and you would get, I think you get into the Oort cloud out there. Well, that's it. You're not going far in the Oort cloud, because the Oort cloud goes out for like 2.5 light years or some damn thing. So these things, these quasars, they deduced could be no more than one light month wide. And they may be only about the size of the solar system. So this is something that's not an entire galaxy doing this. This is something that is, in some cases, the size of the solar system, which to us is humongous. But in cosmic terms, the solar system's, you know, a grain of sand. So they were looking at these things and saying, yeah, okay, we now have these strange spectra, and we have all of that coming from something that's extremely small. And they definitely established that quasars were far away. So in the early 60s, something happened which helped the scientists. The moon was going to eclipse a quasar named 3C273, which is famous among astronomers because it was the first quasar to be identified as such. So the scientists watched this eclipse of the quasar by the moon, and I'm not going to get into too much of how that worked, you know, what they could get out of that. But from the information the scientists gathered from that eclipse, one rather bright person figured out that the weird spectra they were seeing, it was ordinary matter, mostly hydrogen, but the light was redshifted by 15.8%. Which indicated that the source was receding from us at almost 30,000 miles a second, which was an unheard-of velocity for anything back in the early 60s. And not everybody thought of this right away. They'd had some years to say, what is this? But as I said, one bright person came up with, hey, I think it's that. And they said, oh? And because these things deal with numbers, you have a frequency and it has a number, beats cycles per second in those days, but it's now hertz. So you would see how many vibrations per second it was. You could mathematically say, what if this is, let's say, hydrogen? And you know what on Earth hydrogen's frequency is. So you would mathematically shift it down. And when they did that, the spectra they got were perfectly aligned with elements on the Earth. You had hydrogen, you had oxygen, and other elements, and it was all right there. So from that, they said, oh, this stuff is really far away. And, oh, man. So they were amazed at how far away it was. It was very far toward the Big Bang. And they looked at images of the first quasar, 3C273, from the early 20th century because, you know, they do sky surveys. And so they're out there looking at the sky, and they do this, and they see what's up there. And they've been doing this from the 19th century, these big sky surveys. And they found that 3C273 was photographed in the early 20th century a number of times, and it was variable at that time, too. So the variability wasn't something new. And they said, aha. So the scientists concluded that 3C273, the first quasar, was about 2.4 billion light years away, and the redshift was caused mostly by the expansion of the universe. And as we've talked about before, the universe is expanding. This has been shown since 1926 when Edwin Hubble showed that that was happening. And in 1998, we discovered, well, scientists discovered, I didn't discover it. Scientists discovered that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. And by the expansion of the universe, it doesn't mean that it's like all the galaxies and everything are moving through space and moving away from each other faster. It's that space is moving, or between galaxies, more space is being created. And, yeah, basically that's it. Space itself is expanding, and everything in space, including us, is being pushed farther apart from everything else in space. Very interesting idea. And we've talked about that in the past. It's a very complex subject that I'm not going to go into now. This is complex enough. So, the huge amount of energy from quasars, they figured, was obviously the result of supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies. So these quasars are really black holes that are in the centers of galaxies, literally far, far away. By the way, we're lucky that the supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy weighs in at a mere 4 million solar masses, and it's relatively quiet. Basically, it's not eating a whole lot of stars and gas. That's what they refer to black holes as, feeding or eating other matter. And so, and of course, a black hole is this thing that has super-duper gravity, and it sucks everything into it and crushes it down. And once something goes in there, oh boy, there's a big debate about what comes back out, if ever. So I won't get into that. We've done that in a program too. In any event, so we're lucky that we only have a paltry 4 million solar mass black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and that it's not doing much. Because when black holes are feeding, as they call it, they can put out a lot of radiation. And the radiation mostly comes from their poles, because they're surrounded what's called an accretion disk, which is largely gas, but also dust, and anything else that shows up, including an unfortunate star. And entire planets are caught up in this thing. So you have this swirling amount of mass, which itself is going to be huge, and it's swirling around a black hole, and as it swirls around, it lights up because all the parts are crashing into each other because of angular momentum. And what happens is not everything comes from the same place. So things are coming from all sorts of directions, and everything has angular momentum. It's the classic thing of the ice skater twirling around, and if they hold out their hands, they slow down, they don't twirl around as fast. If they hug their hands in real close, they spin much faster. So angular momentum is basically something that everything has, and all of the matter that's falling into the accretion disk has different angular momentum. And so it gets in there, and they crash. And everything in there, the gas molecules, the dust, the planets, the stars, everything is crashing into each other and being torn apart by the gravity. And so the accretion disk puts out an enormous amount of energy on its own, and as the inner part of it falls into the black hole, some of it ends up by the poles. And the black holes have poles. They're spinning on an axis usually. And so at the poles, the black hole puts out what's called a jet. And this jet can be really, really tremendous. and they spew out huge amounts of radiation, and they also spew out matter from those polar jets at relativistic speeds. So you have matter moving at a significant fraction of the speed of light, which is really something. And I have a theory for that. They also produce energy much more efficiently than any reactor or anything else that human beings have come up with. I have a theory of how that happens. I've done it before, but there it is. Anyway, so you don't want to be near a black hole that's too big or feeding. Even our own paltry 4 million solar mass black hole could be a problem if we were over by its poles or something. We got one of those jets at us. Anyway, scientists have been dealing with quasars for decades now, and there are some questions about various things in the early universe. And, you know, the quasars are far away. The closest one is more than 2 billion light years away. And there are other ones that are much farther away. And recently, a team led by, I hope I don't slaughter her name, Priyamvada Natarajan, an astronomer at Yale University, they studied a quasar named UHZ1 because it appears to be the most distant and therefore the oldest quasar that we know of. And the black hole that powers UHZ1 is estimated to be about 40 million times the mass of the sun. So it's 10 times the size of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So this UHZ1 quasar is about 13.2 billion light years away. That means that this huge black hole was operating only about 470 million years after the Big Bang. And the question is, how could that happen? There's not enough time for that to happen. And so Dr. Natarajan and her team members are saying that UHZ1, it's what's called an overmassive black hole galaxy. They're theorizing that the supermassive black hole at the center of UHZ1 did not start out the way other black holes started out, the ones we're familiar with, where you have a star that is big in the first place, it gets older, it goes through a supernova phase, it collapses, and it feeds on other matter or merges with another black hole and gets bigger and bigger. There couldn't have been enough time for that to have happened in a mere 470 million years. So Dr. Natarajan and her team are thinking that huge gas clouds came together to form black holes directly in the early universe. Instead of forming stars, they formed a massive black hole. This raises questions about the role of dark matter in forming these overmassive black holes. The black hole at the center of UHZ1 is about 10% of the entire galaxy's mass, which is extremely unusual. Most black holes are about 0.001% of the mass of their galaxy. So this is like really big difference. So there's something else unusual about UHZ1. And I don't know, maybe the different way that it formed is responsible for it being such a large proportion of that galaxy. And there's no telling how big that galaxy and that overmassive black hole are now, because, again, what we're seeing is 13.2 billion years old. Now, how the theorized overmassive black holes form would have been extremely complicated, because you figure if this mass of gas is there, it could just form stars, right? But it didn't, at least by this theory. And so they're saying it has to be extremely complicated and might involve processes that no one has thought of yet. Like nobody thought originally that the light would be redshifted so far and that you're seeing ordinary spectra, but they're moving away so fast that you have to shift them down to tell what the elements are. So now we have a new type of black hole in the universe, and they are looking at this as a mystery. And what role does dark matter play in this? And I've been critical about dark matter in the past. Maybe that axion thing does hit it, though, but that's another story and another program. So there's a new form of black hole, they think, a new way of making them, and it's even more bizarre than the other stuff about black holes. At this point, I should say that this is WBAI New York. The program is Back of the Book. She is Radio's Pickles of the North, and I'm R. Paul Martin. Oh, who could that be playing the harmonica? Oh, it's the WBAI pitching hobos on the WBAI pitching train. Here's the pitching train again. Oh, boy. Yeah, we are WBAI New York, and we are listener-sponsored non-commercial radio. You do not hear us selling you Super Bowl tickets or any of that crap. You don't hear us selling you gambling stuff. Oh, God, that's another story. And we don't hear any of that. What you hear is programming, mostly. But in the programming, we have to raise money. That's what we're doing right now. We get our money from you, the listeners. We are listener-supported, and we're asking you to become a listener-supporter of ours. We're specifically asking you to become a BAI buddy. A BAI buddy is the name we have for our sustaining members. A sustaining member donates to WBAI once a month. And the way this is done is you call 1-212-209-2950 and say, you want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. And when you do that, at the call center, they'll say, okay, and you will give them your credit card or debit card number, and then you will tell them how much you want to donate. $10 a month, you can donate $15 a month, you can do $20 a month or more if you want. I think the 10 to 20 is what most of our listeners probably will care about. And you donate that. You also tell them what day of the month you want your credit card or debit card charged. And that way, you will fairly painlessly be able to donate to WBAI on a monthly basis. This is important because we have in the past had problems with, oh, God, is there any money? There's no money. How are we going to get any money? And, you know, maybe sometimes having to go on the air and say, we need money right now. And, you know, run down to the station with cash. We've had that happen. And this way, if people donate on a sustaining basis, WBAI can count on getting X amount of money. So by becoming a BAI buddy, you are able to keep WBAI not only getting money, but getting it in a way that management can count on. They can say, okay, we're going to get this amount of money in this month, and they can try to pay the bills with that. And it really makes it much easier when you have a good idea of how much dough is coming in. And we have to pay for we have a bill for the tower rent at Four Times Square. We have to pay for radio station studios on Atlantic Avenue. We've got to pay for a lot of things. Some people actually work here for money. Pickles of the North and I don't, but other people do because you need somebody to come in and feed the hamster that powers everything. Oh, I wasn't supposed to say that. Okay. Anyway, forget about the hamster. Anyway, we need you to call 1-212-209-2950 and become a BAI buddy. We really need to have some people do that. And you will also, we're told you're going to get a WBAI tote bag if you become a BAI buddy. And we also want to thank, again, David, Seth, Tony, and Bettina, who have in the past become BAI buddies and have pledged money. You can also make a one-time donation to WBAI. Say, I don't want to donate every month. Maybe you want to donate, you know, $25 or $50. You can do that. Just call the same number, 1-212-209-2950, and tell them you want to donate one time. It's a one-time donation. pretty much the same process. But we're really looking for BAI buddies at this time. All right, please, please call us at 1-212-209-2950 and say you want to become a BAI buddy in the name of Back of the Book. We'll thank you if you do. That's been it for Back of the Book for this week. Coming up next is...
Everything Old is New Again, Again with Mr. David Kenny.
Again. And so we should be back here next week. We're going to be getting into late winter and, oh boy, spring is approaching. So, yeah, try and enjoy the not-so-cold weather. And above all, remember what that... Looking out for over massive black holes, Dormouse said.
From Brooklyn. Claudette says, keep up the awesome work, WBAI. The work you do in sharing information that would normally not be shared on mass media and essential news programs. Keep running the information that the public doesn't hear anywhere else. Keep informing us on news that the public needs. Thank you so much, Claudette. We love your message to us, and thank you for your contribution. You can join Claudette, who contributed to WBAI for the MLK Collection, with a gift to keep the station running. She gave us $75. Give us whatever you can. Join her and others who support WBAI. Please call 212-209-2950. Become a sustaining member, a WBAI, a BAI buddy, or a contributor, 212-209-2950, or go to our website, WBAI.org, click on the green square with the peace dove on it, and become a BAI buddy, a contributor. Call 212-209-2950 or go to give2wbai.org. Or, there's always an or, send a check or a money order to Pacifica-WBAI. It's tax deductible. Send it to WBAI of any amount. Send it to 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, Brooklyn, New York, 11217.
Hello, I'm Dave. David Rothenberg. I joined up with WBAI not long after Marconi discovered the wireless. If you tune in on any Saturday, that's the name of my program, you'll hear some good music, commentary covering politics, theater, movies, books, and a word or two about the criminal justice system. Actually, it's whatever's on my mind. And there's usually a guest or two to liven things up. Good start for the weekend, so I've been told. Saturday mornings from 8 to 10 a.m. Oh, and I often have tickets for Broadway and off-Broadway shows. You can get to see a play and support listener-sponsored BAI at the same time. I'm looking forward to you stopping by. I can hear you listening already.
Oh, baby, let's have a party.
Let's have a party.
Let's all begin.
This is WBAI, and this is Fred Eagle Smith for WBAI in New York. Stick it in your ear.